The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
That's some sound from 74 years ago at Pearl Harbor, the surprise attack. But should it have been a surprise, given all the warnings in the lead up to December 7th, 1941? We'll get into that in just a moment here from an article at our own website, thetrumpet.com, that we posted a few years ago. First, though, just to give you a heads up on today's program, you're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio show, by the way. Make sure to email us your feedback, your comments, your suggestions, td at kpcg.fm. Later on in the show, we'll go through some reader, or rather listener emails, and also some letters that have come in to this regional office here at Edstone. From some of our readers, those that have become subscribers to the Trumpet magazine or requested other material that this church produces. In the second segment, also, we'll be updating you on the Mystery of the Ages goal and give you the latest on the response to the program from this past weekend, A Tiny Object with One Gigantic Message. That was the program that we played here in the UK on television over the weekend. So coming back to this lesson that we cannot afford to forget, this is what Joel Hilliker wrote on December 7th. This was a few years ago, posted on 2011. He said, many of the personnel at Pearl Harbor were still sleeping that Sunday morning. Even those going about their routine duties were completely unaware that six Japanese aircraft carriers were just over the Pacific horizon, launching waves of fighters, bombers, and torpedo planes their way. Suddenly, their lives were consumed in the roar of diving planes, popping machine guns, thunderous exploding bombs, and the shouts of shocked people trying to summon a response to the surprise strike. He says, the attack holds a vivid lesson for you and me, a profoundly relevant lesson written in the blood of the 2,400 Americans killed 70 years ago today. Of course, now it's 74 years. 74 years ago today. Mr. Hilliker says, and for a number of reasons, it's particularly poignant for us here at the Trumpet. Evidence abounds of a terrible truth. The tragedy of all those lives lost is compounded by the fact that they could have been spared. Before the attack, warning after warning went unheeded. One warning after another. And then in his article, he goes on to list the many warnings and how that they were brushed aside, how that those delivering the message were ridiculed or mocked or silenced. All of those warnings that went unheeded. Later on, he says how easy it is and how distressingly common to overlook a warning. How easy it is to overlook a warning in love. Hindsight, he writes, may be 20/20, but foresight is rare, and acting on it, exceedingly so. Similar unheeded signals preceded 9/11. Yes, we had warnings all the way through the 1990s. There were lessons to be learned in the lead up to 9/11, and yet look at how many people were completely shocked. by that surprise attack. Should it have been a surprise? Mr. Hilliker says, here's why the history of Pearl Harbor is so deeply relevant today. These examples of missed signs and unrecognized threats are mere shadows of a far deadlier surprise attack that is about to descend on us. Are people heeding the warnings today? Well, in the United States, there's a lot of people right now very much disturbed by what's happening in attacks like San Bernardino, what happened in Paris about a month ago. Last night, in fact, President Obama gave his first Oval Office address to the whole nation. And many were expecting some kind of announcement or some kind of adjustment to the strategy, America's foreign policy, the war against terrorism. And really, there was nothing much to announce. Senator Tom Cotton, in response to the president's speech last evening, said President Obama is a wartime president who doesn't seem to realize it. That's how he characterizes this particular president and his administration. And actually, it's even worse than that, as we point out in America Under Attack. But you can understand Mr. Cotton's concern. Here we are at war, and we have a leader who doesn't even realize it. Again, if you look at the key points made in the speech last night, President Obama basically said that everything we're doing to combat terrorist acts, that's pretty much going great, and that nothing much is going to change. He said the country's strong and resilient. He described the foreign policy of the United States as strong and smart, resilient and relentless. We're going to get those terrorists. We're going to win this war. And yet look at the great gains made by radical Islamists. Mr. Obama referred to America's bombing campaign against ISIS, which has been ongoing, but because the rules of engagement are so unbelievably restrictive, most of the aircraft on those bombing campaigns return to their bases without having dropped a bomb, without having fired a shot. Most people don't know this. He said last night that the current policy of admitting all these large numbers of Muslim immigrants coming from Middle Eastern nations, that would continue. This is the American way. No changes to be made in the immigration policies. The only thing really that was suggested last evening was more gun control laws. And this has been a common response to any of these violent shootings. But outside of that, nothing, really, nothing. America's talked about the special operations involvement. 50 people here or 50 troops here. But it's also very limited. And certainly no ground troops are going to be put in Syria or Iraq. Nothing like that. I just want to take you back to, I read a few pieces in the lead up to his address last night, and a couple of commentators had talked about this is his first Oval Office address since August of 2010. And so I thought it would be enlightening to go back to the last Oval Office address. This is the one from August 31st, 2010. So this would be over 5 years ago. And this is when President Obama is announcing the end of combat operations in Iraq. Take a listen.
So tonight, I am announcing that the American combat mission in Iraq has ended. Operation Iraqi Freedom is over, and the Iraqi people now have lead responsibility for the security of their country. This was my pledge to the American people as a candidate for this office. Last February, I announced a plan that would bring our combat brigades out of Iraq while redoubling our efforts to strengthen Iraq's security forces and support its government and people. That's what we've done. We've removed nearly 100,000 U.S. troops from Iraq. We've closed or transferred to the Iraqis hundreds of bases. And we have moved millions of pieces of equipment out of Iraq. This completes a transition to Iraqi responsibility for their own security. U.S. troops pulled out of Iraq's cities last summer, and Iraqi forces have moved into the lead with considerable skill and commitment to their fellow citizens.
That, as I say, was from August 31st, 2010. This was President Obama following through on his pledge, and he's right about that. And America did vote him into office. And he got in there and removed our troops. 100,000 troops removed. Transferring all of those bases, shutting them down, or transferring them into Iraqi hands. Turning it all over to Iraqi forces. And of course, all of this, as we now see, hindsight's 2020, right? All of this, as we now see, gave rise to ISIS. In Iraq, in Syria, it handed Iraq over to Iran, as we've said so many times before. We warned about this at thetrumpet.com. We told you where this was leading. I want to quote to you from a Financial Times piece. This is December 6th, yesterday. It's about President Obama's Achilles heel. Says even before last Wednesday's atrocity, this is the shooting in California, labeled a terrorist act by the FBI, fear of terrorism had overtaken the economy to be the U.S. public's top concern, according to polls. Much of that was in response to the massacres in Paris last month that claimed 130 lives. But the fear index has been steadily rising since videos of the ISIS beheadings of Americans and others started to hit people's screens more than a year ago. And so what does this mean for 2016? That's what this columnist is asking, Edward Luce. What does it mean going into an election year? It says the more anxious Americans become about the threat of homegrown terrorism, the less reassuring they find their administration. President Barack Obama was a paragon of calm in the face of speculation about the San Bernardino attacks. He cautioned people to await the facts, but pointed out such massacres bolstered the case for stricter gun control laws. He showed similar restraint following the Paris slaughter, observing that it was a setback, quote unquote, in a war against ISIS that was nevertheless making progress. A few days later, he said that pressing on with the climate change talks in Paris would be a rebuke, quote-unquote, to the terrorists who wish to disrupt the West's way of life. And then Luce says here, it's hard to fault the content of Mr. Obama's response. Leaders should avoid stoking panic and weigh the evidence before acting. Yet his air of detachment has fed the perception that he is indecisive, or worse, that the measures he's taken so far to combat ISIS have been reactive. Having initially dismissed the Islamist militant group as a minor threat 18 months ago, Mr. Obama has been pressed into taking a series of incremental steps, and that's all that it's been, just incremental steps. And then the big buildup over the weekend to last night's speech, and he goes on for 13 or 14 minutes, and there's really nothing to announce. There's nothing new. It's just his reassurance that everything's going great. That we're pounding ISIS, and we have been for some time. The average American, meanwhile, is concerned. Luce concludes here, each move has been laden with caution. In October, the president said 50 special operations troops would be heading to Syria. They still haven't arrived. This week, another 100 were announced for Iraq. It's hard to escape the impression that Mr. Obama is falling victim to a mission creep in which he does not believe. It's hard to escape that impression. I mean, these are just some of the commentators or congressmen, their reaction to what's happening. And as I said a moment ago, really, it's even worse than these people know. And if you don't have a copy already, you need to get America Under Attack. You need to wake up to the warning, keeping in mind the lesson from December 7, 1941, a lesson that we can't afford to forget. But we have. And look at all of the signs leading up to 9/11. And look at the signs that are out there today. Where is this leading? I listened to a report from Cheryl Atkinson, or one of her reporters, on a new, I believe this is just a website news channel, if I'm not mistaken. In any event, this clip I'll play for you here is an exchange she had with one of her reporters, Scott Thuman, who was, I believe, in Berlin at the time, that he discussed what's happening in Europe and the way Europe views the United States. Notice what they said.
Scott, based on what you've seen, what is it that you think Americans might not understand about the challenges you've seen them face there in Europe?
Yeah, well, I don't know that a lot of Americans would understand how much distaste and criticism there is right now for U.S. foreign policy. When they look at the refugee crisis, they are blaming America in many scopes because they say, had the Middle East not destabilized in the manner that it did, this wouldn't be occurring. And there is a lot of criticism for the fact that the United States is not taking as many immigrants. Look at Germany. They're doing about 10,000 a day. That's the entire year's plan for Syrian refugees in the United States for next year.
The key statement there, that they're blaming America. Now, we've told you in these last several weeks in particular, all of these crises that are coming down on Europe. And how significant is it that even in the midst of these crises, these nations, France, Germany, others, they're blaming the United States. There is a growing divide between the continents. Europe, of course, is taking matters into its own hands, and Europe is looking inward. Great changes are happening in Europe, even as we speak. How will this play out from a prophetic standpoint? Keep in mind, these warnings, hindsight is 20/20, as Joel Hilliker wrote. But foresight is rare. Foresight is rare. Where is this leading? We've talked a lot about the clash between the kings of the North and the king of the South. But what about after that clash? What about after the armies enter into Jerusalem? What about after the city of Jerusalem is surrounded by armies? Then where will Europe turn its attention? Well, going back to what's happening in Europe right now, there's some pretty stunning turns of events in France, in Germany. France's far-right National Front group just came out, as expected, on top in the first round of a regional vote. A lot of headlines coming in from France. Here's one of them: far-right Front National on course to make history. The far-right group in France, it's making history in the French regional election. And then in Germany, you know all about the discontent, how unhappy the German people are with Angela Merkel's administration. This report here from a German publication, it was translated by our news bureau back in Edmond. It shows that 222 violent attacks on refugee shelters have occurred this year. 222. There are great changes happening in Europe. The Washington Post last week, December 2nd, talked about the political crisis the nation is facing. Suddenly, Europe's most durable democratic leader faces the most serious political crisis of her decade in office in opening her country's borders to what one German official called a biblical march of refugees. Merkel called forth a series of paradoxes. On the one hand, Germans are deeply proud of their response to the migrants as tens of thousands mobilized to welcome them at train stations, gyms, and so on. But the initial glow of national pride is now shadowed by doubts, in many cases, anger. The immediate problem for Merkel is that more than 1 million refugees are expected to reach Germany, whose population is roughly 82 million. Even Merkel's sympathizers wonder about the country's ability to absorb many more and the capacity of administrative structures built willy-nilly to deal with the new arrivals. She talks about, or rather this article talks about, how she's struggling, Ms. Merkel, to maintain unity within her own party. Added to that, last week, I believe this would have been Thursday, German parliament, they voted to join the combat operations against the Islamic State. 1,200 soldiers, 6 Tornado warplanes, a refueling craft, aircraft, a German frigate to help guard the French aircraft carrier, logistical help, personnel, satellite links. It passed with an overwhelming majority. Germany's ready to act. I saw this piece over the weekend from the Spectator blog. The title is European Countries Are Now United by War Against ISIS. It's interesting, actually, because one of my assistants who gave me this article right after it was posted, the original title was European Countries Are Now United by a Modern Crusade. European countries are now united by a modern crusade. And then when I went to check up on that a few hours later, the title had been changed to United by a War Against ISIS. For some reason, they wanted to take out that modern crusade. Who knows why they did? Who knows who was behind it at the Spectator? In any event, that's talking about the coming religious war between Europe and radical Islam. It's prophesied in your Bible. It's prophesied. This is foresight, and it's rare. It's rare on this earth. It's easy to look back with 2020 vision. But this is what's coming. Have we learned the lesson from history? Are we tuned in to what prophecy says will happen? This is The Spectator, the same article. I'll stay with the original title. European countries are now united by a modern crusade. It says if anything positive comes out of the Syrian crisis, it is that it's brought the European nations together as never before. Europe is coming together. Now, it's going to be downsized, as we've said, but it is coming together. Spectator says part of me does wonder whether the Germans, having now engaged in military action again, will suddenly find something triggered in their brains. That's a nice way of saying it's in their DNA. It's in their history. And will this action, will this more aggressive posture, will it trigger something in the brains of German leaders? Well, it certainly will in the brain of one, a prophesied strongman, one that the scriptures say will go through a mind change and go off to make war with nations. Well, this Spectator piece, it goes on to talk about the European Union as it is today. and just how that there's not or hasn't been to this point much of a nationalist mindset, because it's been made up of all of these disparate parts. One of the main problems with the European Union is that it was specifically designed by people who oppose nation states and so are incapable of countering national loyalty at a visceral level with their own vision. Look at its banknotes with their imaginary buildings, its bland motto, united in diversity, its ugly headquarters, the colorless language employed by its leaders, who seem to resemble second-rate middle managers. Who would die for the European Union? Or who would even want to burn the EU flag, which installs feelings of emptiness rather than love or hatred? It says the outgroup for European nationalism has traditionally been Islam. That's really what's made, if you look at history, that's what they're saying at The Spectator. What's made the continent become much more nationalist has been its confrontation with Islam. And so there's one last crusade coming. Note the original title of this Spectator piece. European countries are now united by a modern crusade. You think about Daniel 11 and verse 40, they're going to deal with the problem of radical Islam. And then what happens after that? Well, look at how so many in Europe are really upset with the United States, are really blaming the United States for many of the problems that the nations of Europe are facing. Let me just play you one last clip going back to President Obama. It's not from the Oval Office address last night. This is from August 31st, 2010. This would be the last Oval Office speech that he gave before last night.
Today, old adversaries are at peace, and emerging democracies are potential partners. New markets for our goods stretch from Asia to the Americas. A new push for peace in the Middle East will begin here, tomorrow. Billions of young people want to move beyond the shackles of poverty and conflict. As the leader of the free world, America will do more than just defeat on the battlefield those who offer hatred and destruction. We will also lead among those who are willing to work together to expand freedom and opportunity for all people.
It sounds so nice, doesn't it, in a speech? We're pulling out. We're sending our troops home. Old adversaries are at peace. New markets for our goods stretch from Asia to the Americas. We're making a new push for peace in the Middle East. That push, in fact, begins tomorrow. Billions of young people want to move beyond the shackles of poverty and conflict. Billions, he said. Billions want to move on beyond conflict. And America would lead the way. That was August 31st, 2010. Today is December 7th. 2015, and people are concerned. The Middle East is in chaos. The Middle East is burning. Refugees are streaming into Europe by the millions. Americans are upset and worried, fearful, divided. Now, from a prophetic standpoint, what's important to know here, we've talked often about the clash between the King of the North, the King of the South, Daniel 11:40. But think also about what Jesus said in Luke 21, that when you see Jerusalem, you descendants of Israel, the Latter-day nations of Israel, the United States and Britain primarily, and little Judah as well, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by the European armies, then you better know that's a signal that desolation is near. Desolation is near. Going back to Joel Hilliker's piece on Pearl Harbor, he said, very soon, suddenly, their lives will be consumed in the thunder of what Jesus Christ himself called great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. That's what's coming. That's what's coming. I mean, this is a lesson we can't afford to forget. Whether you look at it as prophecy or just learning the lesson of history, like from December 7th, 1941. Look at all of the examples. Even from Jesus himself, Luke 17, go through that chapter on your own. He said it would be just as in the days of Noah. Well, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day when God took Noah and his family into the ark. And the Bible says the flood came and destroyed them all. Have we learned that lesson from history? Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5 that Christ's coming would be like a thief in the night. When people are saying, peace and security. Peace and security. Today, old adversaries are at peace. And emerging democracies are potential partners. We're making a new push for peace in the Middle East. That was said just 5 years ago. President Obama also said billions of young people, they want to move beyond the shackles of conflict. God says when they say peace, then know that sudden destruction is coming. One final bit from Mr. Hilliker's piece. The time ahead will be filled with tragedy, to be sure, but these verses give a clear hope. God warns for a reason. He does promise to spare lives, to spare the lives of those who turn to him. The attack is roaring up from the horizon. Time is short. Heed the warning and live. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm if you have internet access. The email address, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
December 7th, 1941, a lesson that we can't afford to forget. Of course, that date also has special significance to those of us in the Philadelphia Church of God, because it was on December 7th, also on December 7th, 1989, that my father, along with his assistant, John Amos, were fired from the Worldwide Church of God. It was almost 4 years after that church's founder, Herbert Armstrong, died. And in 1989, December 7th, 1989, my father and Mr. Amos were summoned to the Pasadena headquarters and fired that night. But that termination was more of a beginning than it was an end. That was the start of this work that you're now listening to, or that you visit at thetrumpet.com, or that you receive into your mailbox, or that you watch each weekend on television. It all started with that firing. And then later, a few weeks after that, the first mailing of Malachi's message to God's Church Today in January of 1990. And here we are today, just 26 years on. Well, I guess just depending on how you look at it. It's gone by very fast for those of us that have been in the PCG through that time. And I think most that listen in or that have come on board throughout that time period, they're very much familiar with some of the history. If you've read Malachi's message or Raising the Ruins, you know all about the impact that Herbert Armstrong's work had on this world. He was the most prominent religious figure of his day. People read his materials by the millions. People viewed his programs by the millions. He died during the administration of President Ronald Reagan, and Mr. Reagan responded to the church, saying that Mr. Armstrong contributed to sharing the word of the eternal with his community and with people throughout the nation. You can take pride in his legacy. That's what President Reagan said to the people of the Worldwide Church of God. And yet look at how few actually did take pride in that legacy. I can tell you that we did. Everything he did, everything he raised up, everything he wrote, everything he built, it all serves as a model for what we're doing here at Edstone, for what we're doing in Edmond. It hasn't always been easy and smooth going to uphold and preserve that legacy, because so many have been fighting against it. So many have been working to destroy the work of Herbert Armstrong and his material, even his literature. On this day, 26 years ago, the Philadelphia Church of God started with just 12 people and four families. 12 people, four families. I forget what the dollar figure was. I think it was, what, $80? That's all that it started with. And over the time, over 26 years, God has blessed the efforts of my father and the ministers underneath him to reach out to this world in the same way that Herbert Armstrong did. And through that time, through those years, the work has prospered. The operations have multiplied. The people that have sit up and take note, well, there's not as many millions as there were in the 1980s, but tens of thousands for sure, hundreds of thousands, and in some cases with the Trumpet Magazine, the program, my father's program in the States, of course. We've had our battles along the way. 1997 was a momentous year when we started to distribute Mr. Armstrong's books and booklets. The Worldwide Church of God had discontinued all of them. And after we distributed them, they took us to court, saying that we were violating the copyrights on those materials. And we fought in court for 6 years just to make Mystery of the Ages available. Just to make that book available to you. That program we had last week, by the way, the most important book since the Bible. We had 12 more requests trickle in over the last 7 days, bringing the total requests on that program to 232, just four shy of the all-time record, 232. It means that the MOA goal is now up to 1752. We have 248 more to go for the year. Well, we fought beginning in 1997. All the way through to 2003, we fought for Mystery of the Ages, six other books, 11 booklets, and the 36-lesson Bible Correspondence Course. We offered that on TV this past weekend, along with Proof of the Bible. That generated 118 responses. One tiny object with one gigantic message. 118 responses, 118 new people enrolled in the Bible Correspondence Course. Hopefully they'll stick with it. Hopefully they'll graduate the course. Well, along the way, in addition to distributing the literature, we've been massively building up the facilities on the grounds in Edmond, our headquarters campus. We bought that property back in the year 2000. And then Edstone. We just passed the one-year anniversary of this campus. 20 acres. We moved in November last year. The college started in 2001 back in Edmond. And it's spread into the UK. It moved into the UK just this year. Just this year, one letter that we got recently. This is from Northern Ireland. He writes, "Congratulations on your new college campus at Edstone. Thank you for the work that you and your staff are doing, giving a warning of what's to come for this present evil world and giving us hope for the world to come under the rule of Jesus Christ and his chosen saints. Thank you again for the work the church is doing, and may the work be strengthened in the days to come." We have quite a few other responses just like that, coming from all over the UK, Northern Ireland, even a few from the European continent, Malta, elsewhere. Well, we've seen a lot of growth. Someone expressed, one of you listeners, that you just wish there would be more to take note of these warnings, to take note of these lessons that we just can't afford to forget, to take note of these prophecies, which give us so much foresight, and it's rare. But you have to step back and see things in perspective as well. On December 7th, 1989, it was just two ministers, and the weeks that followed, it was just 12 people. In the year that followed, it was just 40 or 50 here and 40 or 50 up in the Ohio area. Here, by here, I mean Oklahoma and Ohio, the two small congregations that started it all. And look at how much it's grown since that time. All the construction, as I say, on the campus in Edmond, the starting of the college in 2001, the mail processing facility in 2004, the Hall of Administration in 2005, 2006, announcing that we were going to build a house for God in 2007, and then the completion of that structure in 2010. We can just conclude by going through a few verses in Zechariah 4. If you'd get your Bible, read along with me. See what God says about any work that begins through human beings. As Mr. Armstrong so often said, it always starts in the smallest of ways. It's a mustard seed beginning. But it grows and grows and grows. It expands and develops. That's always the way it is with God's work. I mean, look at where it was at the time of Mr. Armstrong's death, going right around the world to millions of people, an income that was approaching $200 million per year. And as I was covering in class this morning, as soon as he died, boy, those scholars in the tabernacle, they went right after all the doctrines that Mr. Armstrong taught. They dismantled the spiritual structure. They sold off many of the physical structures. They stopped doing the work. They changed the doctrines. They watered things down. They liberalized everything. They disfellowshipped people for wanting to follow in Mr. Armstrong's steps. They fired them. And then on December 7th, 1989, as I say, it wasn't an end for those two ministers. It wasn't a termination. It was more of a beginning. It was the start of a small, faith-filled ministry that was intent on delivering the same message that Mr. Armstrong proclaimed and amplifying that message so that it would go out to the largest audience possible. Radio, TV, magazines, books, booklets, colleges. God's raised it all up so that you can receive this message right now. That's what it's all for. Zechariah 4 and verse 8 says, "Moreover, the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, The hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And you shall know that the Lord of hosts has sent me unto you." This is a prophecy about the work God did through Herbert Armstrong. All that his hands were involved in. What a builder he was for God. Backing up to verse 6, it says, "Then he answered and spoke unto me, saying, This is the word of the Eternal unto Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." It wasn't by Mr. Armstrong's human might or power. It was all built by God's spirit. That's why what the Laodicean ministers, the scholars in the tabernacle, that's why what they did was so shameful. Because God raised up that work. The power of God's Spirit was behind it. Verse 7 says, "Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you shall become a plain, And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, Grace, grace unto it. Who are you, great mountain? God, just move those obstacles out of the way. Mr. Armstrong, as the autobiography brings out, I mean, he had to fight. He had to fight. He had to struggle against discouragement, adversaries, obstacles to get the work done. But God backed him every step of the way. Verse 10 says, And who has despised the day of small things? Who has despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the Eternal, which run to and fro through the whole earth. But going back to the start of the verse, who's going to despise the day of small things? It all began so small. As Mr. Armstrong said in the autobiography, when God works through humans, it must start the smallest, like the grain of mustard seed, the smallest of herbs, which grows to become the largest. God's work, or rather, God's work through humans, must start the smallest, but they grow and they grow and they grow until they become the biggest. And so whether you look at Mr. Armstrong's work way back in the 1930s or the work of the PCG in December 7th, 1989 and on into the 90s, it started in the smallest possible way, but it has grown and grown and grown since that time. That's because God and His Spirit is behind it. That's the reason. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. We are off and running on yet another week of radio broadcasts that you can receive there locally in Edmond on your radio at 101.3 or online. The live stream's available at kpcg.fm. As the week unfolds, don't forget to send us your emails. You can send them to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.